From the Sky News Centre at 5. Uber has said it will continue its fight against a judgment that its drivers are entitled to things like the minimum wage, sick pay and paid holidays. The taxi app has lost an appeal. The GMB union says it's a landmark victory for workers' rights. The EU's chief Brexit negotiator has given the UK just 2 weeks to clarify how it will settle its divorce bill. Michel Barnier made the demand in a press conference following the sixth round of negotiations in Brussels. Brexit Secretary David Davis again stressed his desire to start trade talks as quickly as possible.
We're making clear progress in building a common technical understanding. This is now about moving into the political discussions that will enable both of us to move forward together. We must now look ahead to moving our discussions onto our future relations.
A Flybe passenger plane has made an emergency landing in Belfast without its nose gear. One passenger has been taken to hospital. A special task force has been set up to deal with sexual abuse cases in Los Angeles. Specially trained lawyers will look into growing numbers of cases in the movie industry. A woman admits she is relieved that the man who's been given her dead husband's face, thanks to pioneering surgery, doesn't look like him. Liddy Ross says meeting the recipient has given her closure after Kalen took his own life last year. Andy Sandness waited a decade for a suitable donor for the transplant after he was left severely disfigured when he tried to shoot himself. He says the operation's not only transformed his face, but his life as well.
You can stand in the elevator and not have to hide your face because you're scared that you're scaring other people. And it's just, now I'm able to go chew food, go sit down in restaurants, and just, it's been unbelievable.
And the former Manchester United defender Patrice Evra has been sacked by Marseille after being banned from all European club matches for the next 7 months. The fullback kicked one of the French side's own fans in the face before a Europa League tie in Portugal. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
Giving you all of the amazing music you can usually expect to hear on BCFM Radio.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping us review this week's news as leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston, and former teacher and founder member of Counter Colson Group, Christine Townsend. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is lurking too. After the 6 o'clock news, horrifying news slipped quietly out this week from MI5 that they could have prevented the Manchester Arena terror attack, since they'd been tracking and following the alleged bomber Salman Abedi for years. The secret services were all over him, and to add mischievousness to mass murder, his father, Ramadan, was a long-time agent of MI6, the other secret service, the foreign service. If this sounds familiar, then there's Michael Adebolajo and Michael Adebowale, who killed British soldier Lee Rigby in 2013. They were sprung from a Kenyan jail and brought to London by MI6. Thanks, guys. In March this year, Khalid Massoud drove over Westminster Bridge to attack the Houses of Parliament. He was on MI5's books for 3 years, previously two. Days before the general election in June, Kuran Butt and Rashid Radwane carried out the London Bridge attacks. Both were close to the top of MI5's terror watch list. But even appeared on a Channel 4 programme as himself, a dangerous, radicalised Muslim. And all of the above have been reported by members of the public to MI5's anti-terror hotline. So, are MI5 organising terror attacks or just watching them as they happen, then hoping to get more legal powers like the Snoopers Charter and public money? What can we do when terror attacks become milk and honey to MI5? One man who thinks heads should roll at the security service is Graham Fawkes, who lost his son David in the 7/7 London bombings. Not only does he want to see unaccountable MI5 chiefs lose their jobs, he wants to take Britain's entire anti-terror apparatus back to the drawing board. Bastion of the Free Press also this week. USA wants restrictions on Russia Today's Washington Bureau and RT America. When it comes to propaganda, they can dish it out, but they can't take it. Also, wonder where all the money's gone. New estimates put the cost of the war on terror at $5.6 trillion. Plus, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman kidnaps Lebanese Prime Minister Saab Hariri and forces him to resign on TV or be executed, getting ready for an epic war with Iran, perhaps. But does he realise he's just dancing to Confederate General Albert Pike's tune, maybe, from 1875? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 9, wet and windy. This weekend, highs up a bit to 14 Celsius. Warmer and wetter tomorrow, sunnier and colder, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs around 11, sunshine and showers and some gusty winds next week. The next weekend, 18th and 19th of November, highs around 11 Celsius, sunny spells but heavy showers. That's next weekend. That was the two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So I'm pleased to say hello to the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Thank you for having
me. You've been a bit embroiled over the last day or so in a scandal, I suppose you could call it a scandal. It's about censorship, though, which is a bit worrying. A poster in the bear pit. Can you tell us about it?
Well, actually, what it was is I got a complaint from a local resident that walked through it. She texted me a picture of it and said, I find this basically offensive and insensitive at this time. I had a look at the photograph, and I do agree, and I sent it on to the council and basically said someone should go look at it. Then, as far as I'm aware, the council went down there. Someone must have agreed with me because they removed it. But this happened, I think, about a week ago. And then, I don't know, I got a phone call yesterday, and everything seemed to have kicked off on it.
It's a poster saying, "Your king and country needs you." This is about the First World War. I'm also joined in the studio by Jeremy Clark, who's one of the people behind this exhibition. Hi, Jeremy. Welcome to you too.
Hi. I'm not actually behind the artwork. The artwork, which Mark and his friends Tato found offensive, was part of the Journey to Justice exhibition, which was in Bristol through October. It featured a dozen famous Bristolians who had stood up for civil liberties across the years. One of those people is Walter Ayles, and it was the Walter Ayles panel, which Mark and his friends took exception to. And it's worth us knowing, I think, who this man was, who Walter Ayles was. He was a city councillor for Bristol in the Eastern Ward. In 1912, he was elected to the city council. In 1916, he was imprisoned for his opposition to the First World War.
Okay, let's just mention some of the words on this, because that's why I imagine that your constituent found offensive, Mark, which is... it talks about the Great War as cold-blooded murder, crimes against God and man to maintain the honour and glory of the British Empire.
Yeah, no, I think we can have a long debate on the motivations behind World War One, about the leadership, certainly, on the Western Front. But actually, the artwork itself is a silhouetted picture of two soldiers, which beneath it, it then says, "Your king, country, need you, cold blood and murder, crimes against God and man." And for me, it was a linkage of those sentiments and the soldiers, because we've got Remembrance Sunday in 2 days. And actually, for me, the link between the two, for young men basically sent off to fight, many of them incompetently led, then to have them sort of labelled with cold blood and murder, crime against God and man, I think is insensitive.
Well, some
if it had had Kitchener, if it had a Kitchener or Haig on, then it's actually an entirely different argument, because I'd probably agree with some of that.
Some would say they're still incompetently led now when they're sent to these foreign wars, Mark.
I would disagree on that.
Well, what, by Tony Blair to Iraq, for example?
We're talking about the government. I was talking about the generals at this point.
Well, the generals are supposed to do what they're told to by the politicians, aren't
yeah,
they?
But you've got the strategy and you've got the tactics. So, I mean, I'm not going to try and defend Tony Blair. I think I'll be the last person that's going to do that, or possibly the second last person, considering I'm on whom I'm with the panel tonight. But I'm not going to defend them. But actually, I do think our standards of professionalism in the military and the fact that we have officers that do, I think, understand the front line puts us in a better stead than we do in the First World War.
Okay, Jeremy, what did you make when you heard that the posters had been taken down?
I thought it was outrageous. This is a man who stood out against the First World War. He was imprisoned for almost 3 years. The idea that his views were entirely unpopular is discounted by the fact that a few weeks after he was released from prison in 1919. He was re-elected to the city council, and 3 years later he was elected as an MP for Bristol North. So this is an important man in Bristol's history, and Mark and his friends want to censor his views and cut him out of history.
Okay, let's just clear this up, Mark. Is this are you acting for one of the people in your ward now, or did you agree that this should have been taken down?
Well, actually, I do agree with that. I think at this point, we've got Remembrance Sunday in 2 days. I do think it's insensitive when you try and link those kind of words to soldiers from the front line. If you can link it all you want to the leadership and the generals, but actually having the silhouetted soldiers with cold-blooded murder, crimes against God and man, it, for me, the artwork is insensitive.
I think at a time when 100 years after the war, when it's widely accepted, as I think Mark seems to be accepting, that war was a complete waste of human life and resources, then it's important that we know that people like Walter Tyrrells said so at the time, and you see the words he used at the time, and that should give us the courage, I think, to say the same things if the need arises in the future.
It's a bit of a drastic thing, though, Mark, isn't it, to say we want to take this down. Actually, this is a piece of public art here.
Well, actually, I asked someone to go look at it. So I wish I had the power that I could suddenly command the council to do something. But someone must have gone out there, they must have looked at it, they must have agreed with me, and it came down. I mean, the Bear Pit does have a bit of reputation for going a bit close to the knuckle on some of this kind of thing. But if it had had Walter Isles' picture on there, or if it had Kitchener on there, I accept the point. But all it has on there is two soldiers, and then below it, cold-blooded murder, crime against God and man. And I think that is insensitive when we're 2 days out from Remembrance Sunday.
Let's just go to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, what do you make of this? Because it does seem that there's a what's happened here is you've got a genuine bit of history, but it's being seen as offensive.
Well, I think the issue is, I mean, who decides what goes up down at the Bear Pit? And in the past, it was used to be just a scruffy part of Bristol, and I understand that it's been subcontracted.
Well, it's being managed by the Bear Pit Improvement Group.
Right, you know. Okay. So in other words, they're the people who decide what does and doesn't go up. But of course, the council, it appears, have the power to intervene. Now, that's what the question...
I mean, the post has gone back up now, I understand.
But, well, I mean, obviously, I would argue that this is legitimate political speech.
But it is... Okay, let's just ask you all about this. Maybe you first, Martin, about this. This is history, and it still seems that there are people today who are really upset about simply... It is effectively the words here, isn't it? The image of soldiers and the words that are effectively saying it's crimes against God and man and cold-blooded murder, Martin.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the point is that there are bound to be different views about these kinds of things. There just is. For example, I'm not wearing a poppy. I don't wear poppies by and large. Other people do. That's fine.
This is another side of all of this, isn't it? Because we're seeing what was seen by many, certainly when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, as a legitimate war in the Second World War to stop the Nazis, now being conflated with things like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, that's a bigger issue. I think in actual practice, you should actually allow people to have... I mean, compared to the sort of wall-to-wall stuff on the mainstream media about Remembrance Sunday, a piece of artwork in the Bear Pit, which has been, you know, obviously been agreed by somebody in the first place, it is a bit insensitive to just close it down. And if, as you say, it may have actually gone back up.
Apparently it has.
Well, we're seeing also a sponsorship of the British Legion by arms manufacturers, people like EADS, aircraft manufacturers, bomb manufacturers, this sort of thing. It's not quite what it used to be, is it?
Well, we've had Ben Griffin on here, who used to serve in the SAS in Iraq, and he's very much of that view, that the Royal British Legion has become essentially, you know, a front organisation. But of course, the Royal British Legion, as you know, Tony, it's actually got as part of its articles of association that it will campaign for the abolition of war.
I'm not sure if it does anymore. I think they've altered all that.
Well, when it was originally set up.
I don't think you call the British Legion a front.
No, a front for arms manufacturers, because they receive money from arms manufacturers. Now, Ben Griffin is ex-SAS British soldier who served in Iraq, and if he was sitting here, that's what he would say to you. I don't necessarily agree with that. I'm just relaying his views to you.
Anyway, so...
I think the problem with Remembrance today is it works on a whole number of different levels. It's perfectly right and proper that we should remember those men whose lives were snatched away from them in the trenches, in World War One, and we should not forget that their lives were sacrificed. But increasingly, over the last few years, Remembrance Day has been used as part of a concerted effort to sell us the wars that are happening now, not just to remember those who were told they were fighting in the war to end all wars. And I think, from what I know of Walter Torrijos, he would be extremely pleased that 65 years after his death, he was still able to upset people like Mark and his friends.
Mark, it seems like one of the monikers from Remembrance Sunday is "Lest we forget." It seems like we have been forgetting, and we're actually getting ourselves embroiled in wars again.
I don't think so. I think, lest we forget, is forgetting all those that have fallen. I mean, we can have debates on the motivations of wars. I mean, World War One is a clash of empires. World War Two is probably ideologies. And we can go through and we can have discussions on all of them. For me, Remembrance Sunday is simply remembering those that fell, actually on all sides of it. And I have issue with the artwork when combined with the words on this picture.
Okay, last word then to you, Jeremy. What would you be thinking about doing similar things in future years now you've had this problem this year?
As I say, I'm not directly involved in that artwork, but what I am involved with. I'm one of the curators of an exhibition which is on the Bristol Cathedral at the moment called Refusing to Kill, which tells the story of Bristol's conscientious objectors, and that exhibition runs until the 9th of January and it includes information about Walter Ayles and his colleagues who opposed the war and those in the community who supported them, and that's in the cathedral. And next year it will be in the Central Library and also in the Record Office. So if people are interested in the subject, over and above what they've heard this evening and in what Mark has been able to say elsewhere, then they need to get down and see the exhibition.
I said the last word, but I think actually you've won here, because what's happened is this poster has been seen on newspapers, the BBC, Twitter and everywhere because of the fact that it got taken down. So anyway, thanks very much, Jeremy, for joining
us
on that. Also joined by Christine Townsend. And Christine, you've been, I understand, down to the cathedral today.
I was, yes. I was down at the cathedral this morning from about 9:30 to about 11:30, something like that. It was charter day for our good people of the city, the Merchant Venturers. So they were down at the cathedral with three of the schools that the institution runs. The private school, Colston's, which is up in Stapleton. Merchants Academy down in South Bristol that's just been found inadequate by Ofsted. And Colston Girls School that is socially selective and ring fences a quarter of its places for children that live outside of the city.
So what was the bishop telling the kids?
Well, we weren't allowed in, of course, unlike you were a few years ago when you got in there and actually taped what the bishop was saying to the children.
I wasn't really supposed to be there. I managed to sort of secrete myself.
Well, that's because it's private, isn't it? And, you know, yet again, lots of people coming up asking if they wanted to get into the cathedral, being told that it's a private service. Again, it's not on their website. There's you know, lack of transparency, lack of openness that these ceremonies are taking place in these public buildings. And, you know, what's the church hiding? What are the merchant venturers hiding? And these schools are funded by the state, so that makes it everybody's business as to the education that the children are receiving behind those doors.
Just run through the schools which they're running. Which are they again?
Well, the ones at the cathedral were their only private one that they officially run, which is the Colston School up in Stapleton. Colston Girls School, which is on Cheltenham Road, they were in there today, and so were children from Merchants Academy, which is now all through. So they take primary and secondary, and there was a group of primary school aged children in there today, getting the children nice and young. But the other schools that they also run, Barton Hill, which is over at, just up the road from here, that's also inadequate from Ofsted. Bannerman Road, which is over in Easton, that's good from Ofsted. The Dolphin, which is now, they want to make that the feeder primary school to Colston Girls. Kingfisher, which is out in St Anne's, that's inadequate. And they also run Fairlawn School, which is relatively new, and it's on the old Montpellier site on Ashley Hill.
Well, I did invite the Merchant Venturers, gave them a call yesterday, see if they could, one of them could come down and speak to us today. Really asking, there's a chap called Cullen McAlpine, who's the present master, Charles Griffiths, who's just been made master for this and next year today, and Tony Kenny, who's the junior warden. He will be made master, I imagine, next year. Mark Weston, what do you make of these this organisation running our city? I suppose the main problem, as I can see it, is that there's just no transparency with their accounts at all. They're running under a royal charter, mm-hmm. Where they don't have to submit anything to Companies House at all, so we don't know what they're up to.
No, I mean, from an educational point of view, I'm afraid I actually think they're doing some good in the city.
What, you're pleased that they've got three schools that are inadequate by Ofsted?
I'm sure they're working hard to remedy that. I mean, I know how heartache it is.
That's the idea that they took over as that the idea of a sponsor of a multi-academy trust is that they take over schools and they improve them. So what's happened with Merchants Academy is they took it over when it was good and it's now inadequate. That's what's happened.
And they're going to have to work very hard to try and improve it. And I'm sure they will be trying to
do that. Do you think they've got the capacity to do it? Do you think they've got the skills to do it?
Hang on a second, Christine. Mark, it does look as if maybe the schools aren't so good now the Merchants are running them.
Well, I mean, if they can't improve it, genuinely, if they can't improve it, then they're going to have to look again. And I think we're all going to have to look again at what happens with those schools. But I do think the Merchant Venturers, on the whole, and it's an on balance, and I realise the temperature that this gets on it, I think on the whole, the Merchant Venturers do good for the city. I think they do need to be a bit more transparent in what they're doing, and I certainly would hope that they're working hard to remedy the problems they got in three of their schools.
What evidence do you use to base your claim that you think that the Merchant Venturers are good for our city's schools? What evidence have you got for that, Mark?
What do you think they're doing wrong?
It's not me, it's Ofsted that are going in and inspecting schools, and they're finding them to be inadequate.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what happened at the City Academy when John Laycock, who was a merchant venturer, was the chair. That school was found to be institutionally racist, and they were found to be Ofsted inadequate. What the Merchant Venturers then did was offload that secondary school onto the Cabot Learning Federation, and John Laycock went down to the Merchant Venturers and is now on the governing body at the Merchants Academy. He's now on the Merchants Academy, and that's just been found to be Ofsted inadequate.
Well, at that point, they're going to have to review their leadership, because if that's what's going to happen each time...
That's the sponsor, which is the Merchant Venturers that I'm speaking about.
No one wants to see a school go into into any kind of a poor state of repair. They don't want the standards falling at all, and they're going to have to turn it around. And if they don't, we're going to have to look at it.
How long are you going to give the education? Because every day that's missed for a child, there's now thousands of children in inadequate schools that are run by the Merchant Venturers right now. So on Monday, thousands of children will be having an inadequate education. Every day that's lost is a lost day for those children, because you don't get it back. Children don't get about their education. How long, as the leader of the Tory party on Bristol City Council, will you give the Merchant Venturers before you start asking questions and start speaking to the Merchant Venturers, but also the Regional Schools Commissioner, about having these schools taken away from this institution?
Okay, Christine. Yeah.
Okay, first of all, I haven't gone through each and every one of those.
Well, I have, and I've just told you what it is.
What I haven't, though, is seen what exactly that they need to improve on. So I will go away and look at that, but I don't know. So I'm going to be honest and say I don't know. So I'm going to have to look at that and see what the problems are and see what they're doing to repair.
So if we're in the same,
but I'm not actually in the position of authority on this, because I'm not the mayor.
If we're in the same situation next year with these inadequate schools, do you think?
Well, at that point, we really do have a problem.
So 12 months from charter day, then. So the next charter day for the Merchant Venturers, you and I, Mark, can come in here.
I'm not going to play fast and loose with an artificial.
Mark,
this is about children.
Christine, we know you've had your say, Christine. Now, Mark, I just want you to now tell us why you think this whole academisation thing is actually may work.
Well, actually, I'm afraid I do believe in having greater freedom for schools, and I think academisation does do that. I think they have greater control over their curriculum. I think the head teachers have more control over the way the school operates without LEA control. So, actually, I'm in favour of academisation.
Why have we got such a bad record here in Bristol? It seems even now we've tried this academy system, and it still seems that our schools aren't really up to scratch.
Well, the thing is, our schools are actually better than they were. I mean, in my area, the local school is Henbury School, and actually, they've done a phenomenal job of turning that round. And all my hat's tip to the head teacher there, and she's done really well, and standards are up year on year. And I don't know what the full answer to that is, academisation or not, but it's definitely down to an awful lot of hard work that she's put in. And so, well done to her.
Okay, not a question for Mark this time, Christine. Please just make your point.
Okay, so what I would say about academisation is that it's not academisation per se that's the issue. As you say, Henbury has turned themselves around. The issue is about who it is that's running the academy. And the merchant venturers were the first in the city to become involved in running academies in this city in 2003 when they took over St George and it became the City Academy. They are the most experienced provider of academisation in the city. And what we are now seeing are the schools that they run providing inadequate education for our children. That's what the reality is, and that's what the politicians in this city need to get a grip of.
Now, when it comes to the merchant venturers and the slave trade and Edward Colston, the Bristol Post editor Mike Norton has weighed in on this. He says, why Bristol needs to face up to its past before it can enjoy its future. The comment from the editor: Bristolians can be frustratingly tight-lipped about the city's past, but Post editor Mike Norton wants to get them talking about it. Last week, he says, I decided to walk to a meeting in Clifton from the post offices on Temple Way. It was a bright November morning. The city looked beautiful in the long shadows of the golden winter sunlight. My route took me across Castle Park, past Corn Street, down Broad Street, blah, blah, blah. So he says, Bristol has history, all right, except the problem with Bristol's history is that much of it has been reduced to just that, history. It's past. It's all about the buildings now, the spires, the domes, the high windows and the trading halls. Well, I'm not going to read any more of this, but Mark, what he's saying effectively is that we really need to deal with this whole business of Edward Colston once and for all, and not necessarily get rid of Colston, but to make sure that the people that helped to end the slave trade have some kind of equitable value as him. Maybe some buildings named after people that did that. Maybe some statues to them too.
I would actually agree with that. I don't think we can scrub Colston out of our history, so I'm not after renaming. I think it all comes down to education. I think we need to make sure in our schools, so we're back to schools again on this, we actually teach it warts and all. I mean, I'm actually not Bristolian by birth. I'm from near Liverpool, which has similar problems in its past with the slave trade there. So I think what we need to do is teach everything about our history, including the bits that sometimes make us uncomfortable, because they should make us feel uncomfortable. And so that should include the likes of Colston, about what he did and where his money came from, but also about the abolitionists and Wilberforce's friends and everything else, about what they did to get rid of it. And I think that would be worthwhile in the extreme, and we think we should do it.
He says also, we've got a black elected mayor, but how many black merchant venturers do you think there are? Here's a clue: it's none. Let me give you one small example of how Bristol can let itself down culturally. On Friday night, he says, I was at a fabulous dinner in town to celebrate 800 years of the Lord Mayor of Bristol. The banqueting hall of the Harbour Hotel was packed to its painted rafters with hundreds of Bristol's so-called great and good. A fantastic occasion which raised a lot of money for charity. But there were just two black people in the room, Christine.
Well, you know, I mean, the Post has sort of done a 180 degree turn somehow, because as a Bristolian, I remember when the Post was very much against this, and they would defend the figure of Colston as the way that Colston is portrayed through the statue as the great son of Bristol. So I was quite interested to read this. What I also find interesting is there comes a point when discussion is such that the institutions themselves want to somehow take hold of the narrative so that they then become in control of what any changes that might take place. And I'm a bit suspicious, I'll be honest, that the editor of the Post has come out and said written this particular article.
Martin?
Well, We've had this debate several weeks running now, haven't we?
This is about big events going on right now in the city, and this in this occasion, 800 people there, but only two.
The fundamental problem is that the merchant venturers are essentially the wealthy elite of the city, and not surprisingly, there are not many black faces there. You'd be surprised if there were.
That wasn't just the merchant venturers.
No.
This is a charity.
Well, I suppose that's the point, isn't it? If it's a wider thing, then they could surely have invited a widest cross-section of people. I don't really know what this event was. I'm not really sure what it was or what they're trying to achieve by having it. I think the role of the merchant venturers in the city has got to be confronted. As you know, Tony, we've only had them on one time. They managed to get somebody on here. And as you know, he had quite a hard time because he was on the board of Bristol Water. And that very morning, they'd been fined by Ofwat for overcharging massively, as the biggest overcharges in the country. And he didn't get an easy ride, did he?
No. And also, this does kind of echo with some of the wider stories this week. We've seen revealed the Queen's private estate invested millions of pounds offshore. And this also, Prince Charles as well, coming for a lot of criticism with these Paradise Papers, where they're saying effectively that Prince Charles has been lobbying for the schemes to do with carbon trading, whilst at the same time setting up secretly a company which is benefiting from carbon trading. Mark, what do you make of this? This Paradise Papers, obviously someone has hacked, stolen these somehow, this information, but what it shows is an absolute litany of tax avoidance, doesn't it?
It does. One of the things I did like to know, and I genuinely don't, because context is everything, is who did get the information, sort of what the motivation was behind that. Do we have everything? Do we only have selective highlights of it?
I don't imagine the Queen's in there and everything. You know, it's quite a lot. If it was me, you know what I'd do? I'd send someone in to get a job in there.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, I don't know how they managed to get it out.
Isn't that how you do it?
I'd imagine there were a few people in the Paradise Paper boardrooms, sort of as it were, going, how the hell did they get this out? I don't think they wandered out on a USB
stick.
But
the wider point is that the poor are being taxed more, but the rich are being allowed to squirrel their wealth away abroad. In irony, the Queen being involved, she's the person that appoints most of the officials to these crown dependencies.
From what I was reading on the BBC, though, she didn't actually avoid tax. She still paid the tax due.
Well, she does pay tax on other things, but apparently she's not paid tax on these offshore investments because no one knew she
had them.
I
read it different on the BBC, though, but this is more information comes out every single day.
This is on The Guardian, reveals the Duchy of Lancaster put money into a retailer criticised for exploiting poor families too. Millions of pounds from the Queen's private estates invested in a Cayman Islands fund, part of an offshore portfolio that's never before been disclosed, so she certainly hasn't been paying tax.
No, we're going to have to look at it. I mean, this is affecting a wide range of people, not just the Queen and Prince Charles, but it's all going to be considered.
But the Conservatives are seen as the party that are now taxing the poor and letting the rich off scot-free.
Hang on a minute, because actually when you look at things like tax avoidance, actually the Coalition and the Cohen government have clamped down hard on it, actually. We brought in about £160 billion of additional income by doing these kind of clampdowns.
Cameron was campaigning to close down tax havens back whenever it was, 2 years ago. No, yeah. 2015, when they had the general election. When Theresa May had her general election earlier this year, there was not even a single mention of closing tax havens.
A lot of work has already been done on this. So actually, if you look at the international financial regulation, for example, look at the Channel Islands, they're actually adhering to all the international regulations.
The world is pointing the finger at Britain and at the Queen, actually, saying crown dependencies are the main place where this money's being kept.
Well, no, they're different financial authorities on it, in fairness, but actually they do conform to the international standards. Now, we can now have the argument about what should those international standards be? Don't think it is right that you have things like multinationals that are able to move their taxes or move their profits and everything else to avoid tax and bounce it from one financial regulated authority to another one in some kind of clever shell game where we never quite know where it all goes.
So should we close these tax havens down once and for all and tell the Queen, no, you can't appoint people to run your own funny money?
Well, no, she's going to... I mean, we want a situation where actually the estates of the... Prince of Wales and the estates of the Queen are run at arm's length. So actually, because otherwise they're in too much of a position of authority. So from what you can see on the Charles situation, it looks like he had no idea that these investments are happening because he doesn't manage the day-to-day of his estates.
Apparently he sticks his nose into everybody's business apart from his own.
He does lobby high hard on the environment. I'm not too sure that people are that angry with him about that element of what he does.
Well, this is... Yes, but what he's saying is he's lobbying, taking a specific...
But he wouldn't have known about his investment. That's the thing.
I don't agree. I think he know exactly what he's invested in. Martin, this is one of the things that is mystifies a lot of people, this carbon trading business, but it looks as if Prince Charles has been lobbying for it whilst quietly creating a company to profit from it.
Well, it may be that he knew, and it may be that he didn't. I think that's an issue to be established, is it not? I'm not in favour of carbon trading anyway, because it's actually...
Do you honestly believe this? Him throwing out his hands, so I knew nothing about this multi-million pound company
I think it's something that we need to establish. Let's put it that way. It's something that needs to be established. Now, it's suggested...
What is this carbon trading business?
Well, carbon trading is the idea that there's a ceiling for each country depending upon how much previous carbon they've emitted, and then a trading system is set up to trade these credits. So countries, poor countries, get big credits because they haven't released a lot of carbon. Countries which are wealthier get lower credits, and then they're supposed to trade. But, of course, what it is another way for hedge funds to make money. If you want to
Isn't
stop...
It's a sort of get-out for it's climate a way, change.
It's a market solution. Supposedly,
so you can buy your way
warming.
Into polluting, basically.
Yeah, but that means a transfer of funds, supposedly, from relatively developed societies like Britain to relatively undeveloped societies
in
Africa,
and the banana republics and the crooked people.
Yeah, well, I'm
them.
Against carbon trading in principle because it's basically trying to create a market solution for something. If you're going to have a solution on carbon on carbon emissions, you've actually got to have economic.
I mean,
planning.
You know what annoys me more than anything else about this Prince Charles business is he has been also lobbying to block any kind of freedom of information requests. So he's saying, I'm not part of the government, I'm a private person. And yet then he's got the Duchy of Lancaster to do all this stuff for him.
Can I just make a point on that? It could be argued that the Duchy of Lancaster and all the rest of it is in fact public property. It belongs to the Crown. But if we were to, you know, it could be regarded the Crown is actually, since the Revolution of 1688, is in fact the public realm, and therefore they're not even private monies. And you've got to remember, before Queen Victoria came along, there was no money from the civil list for the monarchy. They lived off their own, and we're going back in a long way now into medieval history about, does the Crown actually own this at all, or does it belong to all of us?
For me, I just want to weigh in on the freedom of information on Charles. I think his private correspondence, he is a private individual, so that probably isn't subject
to
FOI.
Well, so is Theresa May.
But I would say that his financial affairs, I kind of think I would agree with Martin, actually. I think they are subject to scrutiny.
They should be.
Do you think that the merchant venturers' financial affairs should be subject to scrutiny, given that they're running public services?
I think the schools' financial budgets and everything else should be, because actually...
But not the sponsor that actually run them?
Well, if they don't legally know... Because actually, and not every single club and society and everything else in the country would release all that information.
Wouldn't it be interesting to know how
it's
much the merchant
ownership.
Venturers have invested
would
in the
private company
in
release
the Cayman
all
Islands?
No,
but private companies don't run state schools.
Which is why the state school budgets for those schools, so the Merchants Academy, should publish their accounts.
And because, they do.
Well, and they do. But actually... Well, you wouldn't have, for example, Apple publish all of their accounts and information. We might actually wish they would, considering.
But Apple don't run our state schools.
No, but equally, if they did, would you expect?
But they don't.
But if they did, would you expect Apple to release all of their financial information?
I would want to know where Apple have their investments.
Mark, are you seriously defending the merchant venturers, saying we don't want to publish our accounts?
But you're actually effectively
saying that whatever money they've got, it needn't be declared.
It doesn't matter where it is. It doesn't matter whether they pay tax, whether they're investing offshore, it's fine. They can run our state services, they can run our NHS.
Hang on, Christine. It could be invested
in
China, Russia. It could be invested anywhere.
You're asking for a dual standard on here. The schools themselves should and do publish their accounts. But would you expect every single body in the world to publish their accounts?
If they were running state schools, yes, because state schools are about ethics and morals. And if you're investing in things that are not ethical or moral, how are you able to then run state schools?
Well, let's imagine you had a situation where, I don't know, a shipbuilding firm decided to sponsor an engineering academy, so they could bring in apprentices and all the rest of it. Would you expect that company to then publish all of its economic accounts?
But I would expect that company to be open and be able to demonstrate that where they use their money stands up to the ethics and the moral and the mission of the school that they are sponsoring.
Just a second, you two. Let's let Martin Summers have a word.
The reason why the merchant venturers do not submit accounts is because they're incorporated under Royal Charter. That's why. Now, in other words, we come back to the question we were saying earlier, like the Duchy of Lancaster or whatever. It's to do with medieval legal practice. That's what we're talking about here. Now, in actual fact, if merchant ventures were set up today, they would have to actually put their accounts to Companies House. But because they were set up in the medieval era, under royal charter, they don't have to.
So you're happy with these medieval standards of reporting, are you?
Well, I think we're applying a dual standard after the fact. You wouldn't expect other sponsors to publish everything else that they do. The schools publish their accounts. And just because we don't happen to like the merchant ventures doesn't mean that we get to have a big stick to beat them with it.
Well, it's about publishing your accounts, isn't it?
I think, the schools do publish their accounts.
We're not talking about schools. We know what
happens with the money.
I would argue
schools.
That the merchant venturers should publish their accounts. I mean, even though they don't have to, it might be a goodwill gesture to do that, wouldn't it?
It's a choice that they could have. Do you think they should? If we were
going forward to...
Okay, I think everyone's made their views very clear on this. Let's talk now about Priti Patel, because she's another cabinet minister. We had one last week, Michael Fallon, and this week Priti Patel has fallen a sword, Mark, although actually she's really been sacked. She was running a parallel foreign policy. Actually, former Foreign Office people, I was looking at an article yesterday saying actually she fulfilled all of the criteria of a spy.
I wouldn't
running
call her a spy.
Totally parallel foreign policy.
I think she messed up.
She's running rings around Theresa May, isn't she?
I mean, I think she messed up, and she basically got fired for that. That's quite right.
But what? So I mean, was it a mistake? Is that what you're saying?
Well,
how can you mistakenly meet 12 times?
No, she shouldn't have done it.
12 times.
She shouldn't
have
done it. Oh no, she was naughty, and she shouldn't have done it, and she's been fired for it.
Okay, so what was the motive of meeting with a foreign power 12 times without informing the Foreign Office or Downing Street?
I'm afraid I genuinely don't know. What
I mean,
it was.
if you were in her shoes as Development Secretary...
No, I wouldn't have done it.
Well, why might she do it, Martin?
Well, I mean, she's very close to the Israeli lobby. And Liam Fox had a similar problem with his chum Werity going to meetings without...
In 2011.
And Werity, of course, didn't have security clearance and was going to meetings and so on. And he had to resign over it.
And Werity was also advertising his closeness to the Defence Secretary and everything else.
From a sort of gossipy political point of view, it's very bad news for the government because it just looks incompetent for people to be doing things like this. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also, I mean, if I can just remind people what happened some years ago when Tony Blair was Prime Minister. He flew to Washington to talk to George Bush immediately after Ariel Sharon had been there. And he came, as soon as he'd spoken to Bush, they came out and gave a press conference and said that they agreed they changed their position on the Israeli settlements. And Robin Cook, who was Foreign Secretary at the time, and the Foreign Office were furious because Blair had changed Britain's position after a five-minute talk with George Bush for Britain's position of over 50 years. And, of course, Priti Patel was also talking to the Israelis about the possibility of supplying them with British funds for their occupation of the Golan Heights, which is against British policy. Mm. British policy has always been...
Similar thing with Blair is he was also... He announced to the public that he was sending 40 Commando down in Taunton over to Afghanistan. The next week we heard from 40 Commando, "We're not going." So he seemed to be trying to run things.
Well,
we're in a situation. All I'm saying though is with May now, she seems to have absolutely no political authority whatsoever.
I would disagree because actually she fired Patel, so obviously she has some authority on it.
Only when she was forced to. There are reports saying that the Downing Street actually told Patel, "Don't let anyone know about these secret meetings you've had with Netanyahu because it's really embarrassing."
Yeah, now, that comes from one source. It isn't corroborated anywhere.
It's the Jewish Chronicle who have an axe to grind.
From my point of view on this, you can't have a minister, and as much as I respect Priti Patel because I haven't met her, as much as you can't have a minister trying to almost conduct a separate foreign policy. So, I mean, the government policy didn't change, but she shouldn't have held those meetings.
How long can Theresa May carry on like this?
I think Theresa May won't be got rid of anytime soon.
Really? Well, the bookies don't agree with you because this week they've been knowing the odds.
The bookies are covering their spread.
They also
it doesn't
have,
actually rate chances.
Do you reckon they don't have any kind of inside sources
no,
at all?
No, I don't.
They do. They love to make. They're proud of the fact that they do. Anyway, Christine, what do you make of this whole Priti Patel business, and what does it say about the present government?
Well, for me, it's the second minister that's had to go. It's on top of what's coming out of Westminster around the behaviour of top ministers and politicians and abuse of, it's about abuse of power. That's what it comes down to, is that Priti Patel felt that she was in a position whereby her government was very weak, and she took advantage of that. She knew exactly what she was doing when she went to Israel, and she failed to tell the Foreign Office. She knew exactly what she was doing when she met the Israeli Prime Minister. Of course she did. She didn't make a mistake, Mark. This woman is a very intelligent woman. She knows exactly what she's doing, and she's taken advantage of it. She's using the political position. It's very political what she did, and she's been caught out from it. But the thing is that in a few years' time, I have absolutely no doubt that Priti Patel, once the Tories recover, in a generation or so from the weak position that they're in at the minute, if the British public ever do forgive them for the mess that they're going to make that is Brexit, then Priti Patel will come back. I've got no doubt about it, because she's clearly a very astute player. It's just that this time she got caught out because there was a journalist that exposed her.
Okay, well, Brexit is mentioned, and we've got the Christmas market that's appeared in the middle of the city centre this weekend, just opened. Now, I was wandering through there the other day, wondering to myself, now, if this was a kind of Italian market or a French market, maybe we wouldn't have voted for Brexit. It's just that the Germans seem to dominate everything, and there's this kind of residual feeling that there's this kind of humourless German thing appears in our city every year. And why aren't there more local traders given the opportunity to do this kind of thing? Anyway, Mark, what do you make of Brexit and the market?
That's a new conspiracy theory for me, Tony. I've not heard that one.
Well, it's
from
not
you
a conspiracy
before.
Theory. I'm just wondering.
I'm not
isn't
sure
the
you
EU,
could link Brexit
the EU
with the Christmas market in
okay,
Broadmeat.
Isn't the EU just a bit too German?
No, it would run more efficiently if it were, I guess. No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't actually think the Germans want to lead the EU, but their economic clout means that they are doing it. And it's going to be interesting. We now know the date of departure, 29th of March, 11 p.m. And we'll see what happens. It's going to be entertaining, as it were.
Christine, is the EU a bit too German?
It's not a particular interpretation that I've necessarily thought about when it came to the EU.
No.
But that isn't why, you know, that isn't why 52% of the population or whatever it was voted to leave, was
no,
it?
No.
I mean, you know, it wasn't
no.
because
well,
of
maybe
Germany.
Maybe I'm just in my mind conflating two stories here.
Anyway, it's possibly an oversimplification.
Would you have preferred a French market or an Italian market, Mark?
I'm a big fan of Italian markets. I'd happily go for one of those. But
there's something sort of unimaginative about the sort of bratwursts and, Martin.
Well, it's there every year, presumably, because it's commercial success. That's why it's there.
Yeah, but I suppose it's about the money that brings all these people there. And, there must be loads of local people that could be doing similar sorts of things.
Well, I mean,
if only there was a mechanism to bring them into the city centre to help sell their wares.
Well, I'm not quite sure how, what the actual commercial arrangements are around the Christmas market. I mean, I quite like German beer and sausages. So, it actually suits the weather and Italian food. No, I prefer the Italian weather.
I prefer German beer and Italian wine. If there's a way to sort of combine the two.
But anyway, on the general, bigger picture of Brexit, I'm afraid, whatever your views on it, it is gradually turning into a train wreck. And what will probably happen is there's a kind of investment strike. The CBI this week was saying, you get this deal sorted out, otherwise we're going to have to start making decisions to move production elsewhere. And at some point, somebody like George Soros is going to take a short position on the pound, and that's a one-way bet. And at that point, the pound collapses, they have to raise interest rates, and then we get the Brexit recession, which many economists have predicted. And at that point, I think the government, if they're still in power, will be in a very, very weak position.
On to a more serious subject. Mum of four has died in the cold and alone after her benefits were blocked for missing a meeting. This was in the Metro this year, and this, I suppose, is the downside of austerity, Mark, and why a lot of people are pointing the fingers at Ian Duncan Smith particularly, but the Conservatives generally, and saying, well, this is the nasty party.
Afraid, I don't know the detail. When did that happen?
This
can
is,
you provide any more detail?
This is just on Wednesday this week, published in the Metro. Mum of four died cold and alone after her benefits were cut because she was too ill to attend an employment support allowance meeting. Elaine Morale was found dead in her home wearing a coat and scarf, a family claim. 38-year-old had her benefits stopped because she failed to attend a meeting while she was in hospital intensive care unit, they said. Elaine, who suffered from an eating disorder and mental health problems, was found dead earlier this month in Runcorn in Cheshire.
Well, I mean, that'll need investigated because that's awful.
Yes, but I mean, how can this be allowed to happen?
Well,
whoever's cut that benefits off to that woman has killed her.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that they didn't realise that she was in intensive care when it happened. And the benefits are under review. I don't know the circumstances on that one. I would have to know more, and I'll go away and have a look at it. It'll have to be investigated because someone will have to look at this. But actually, I don't want to desensitise it, but actually, the benefits themselves, people do have obligations in order to receive them. One of those is to attend meetings. But there always should be a means by which you can move it or provide the excuse, because obviously this woman was incapacitated at the time. She was in intensive care. So I will need to know more, but that is disconcerting.
Yeah, I mean, it's what the DWP have said. Anyone who disagrees with the decision can appeal, presumably from their intensive care bed.
Yeah, well, this is one of the problems. I mean, she would have been able to appeal it, but if she was that ill, then she's in a position where she's probably unlikely to be.
So are you looking forward to universal credit? Do you think this is going to be a great success?
I have an issue with universal credit on the amount of time before you get it. Because at the moment it's 6 weeks. I think that needs to be 4 weeks. If it's going to mimic salary, which is, I think, the purpose of it, and then have the taper down so that, you know, it's not the cliff edge in the current benefit system, which I think is a good thing, then I think 6 weeks is too long. It's got to be 4 weeks before you get to it.
Martin, you actually were claiming for a while universal credit. Mm-hmm. How did you find it?
I'm afraid the problem with the design of it is that it's designed to be punitive. So that's why you've got the weight. I mean, the previous system was, if you turn up to say, I need money, then you try and give money to people as quickly as possible so they don't get into rent arrears.
I mean, wasn't that the basic principle of national insurance, that when you lose your job,
that's right.
Well, you get the money?
I should have been able to claim unemployment benefit, but, of course, you can't claim unemployment benefit now. It's been rolled out to people over 55 who are single, which is what I clarified in Bristol. But if it was unemployment benefit, of course, you were entitled to claim that because you'd paid in. And then you went on to job seekers allowance after you'd run out of 3-year unemployment benefit. And that was basically mimicking a private sector system. Yeah, so you pay in while your national insurance, and then you get money out. And they didn't used to put pressure on people back in the day to get to look for work. It's up to you to look for work. This is, you've got a window while you're on unemployment benefit. Because, you know, that you're entitled to that money because you've already paid it in. But universal credit is very much a handout, which is very much dependent upon you doing things that they want you to do.
You're also looking for work. I mean, that's
yes, I know, but it's too. Ultimately, the idea of a universal credit could be easily be switched to a universal payment to everybody. I mean, the right wing government in Finland are now rolling this out as an idea. You know, they're experimenting with just giving people money and saying, right, you sort yourself out without us bothering
you. Let me say why I think the Finns might be doing this, and that's because if people don't have anything to survive on, they die in Finland.
Well, in Britain, clearly, as this lady did with four children.
So, Mark, this austerity, you think it's working?
Well, the deficit is coming down. I mean, I do fundamentally believe, as a point of principle, the country has to find a way to live within its means.
But the national debt is going up, isn't it?
Well, that's because the deficit hasn't been eliminated.
In fact, some say there's something like an extra trillion of national debt that they're not acknowledging.
The only way you'd stop debt rising is if you had no deficit at all. So at that point, we're still 52 billion away from that. Now, you would hope that actually economic growth and things like that will take some of that away, so it does some of the heavy lifting for you. But I do think, as a fundamental, the country has to live within its means. Otherwise, you're simply running up debt and handing the bill to your children and asking them to pay it off.
So can we afford things like HS2, Hinckley C? I mean, actually, that's private money in Hinckley C, isn't it?
I think you know that I'm not a fan of HS2, because we've had this debate before. I would scrap HS2. And I'd actually much rather the money went to building additional housing and providing money for suburban rail.
Talking of which, we've had news this week. It looks like the arena, Bristol Arena, is being killed stone dead on that site. Anyway, it might possibly be built out in the middle of nowhere in Filton.
I wouldn't quite go that far. I mean, what are they doing? They're doing a review because it's. I mean, I don't have the figures, so I can't give them. But
123
with 100, yeah, I know the budget, but I don't know what the quote was because it must have been significantly more on Arena Island. So they're considering how do they bridge the gap, the finances on that? Can you get private investment in it to cover it? But they're also looking at other site options, and one of them is the Brabazon Hangar. Now, at the moment, that is on its own. But actually, you've got to remember, this actually forms part of the Cribbs Patchway new neighbourhood housing. There's 5,700 homes going in there. There's a Metrobus link. There's a new train station going in. There's new roads coming in off the motorway. So you need to imagine it in 5 years' time, not as it is now.
So they've handed the site by Temple Meads to the university, but build more student flats, isn't it?
No, well, they could. Actually, we still have the Arena Island section for the arena. That's still us. There's a campus going next door as well. All this is having to be looked at, because I think we all, probably all of us in this room, probably do want an arena, but the problem is there is an unlimited pot of cash, so it's not an arena at any cost. So actually we should, sensibly, and this is one of those I'm afraid where I do agree with Marvin, we do need to look at other options, including finance and other locations.
So do you think that the City Council should be investing in this when we're closing libraries?
Well, I mean, the money itself actually doesn't come from the City Council. It comes from the growth deal. So it's different pots of money. The Council's actually not putting any of its own money into it. So we've actually already managed to raise money from the growth deal, from the LEP and the WEP, and from the organiser that's going to run it.
These people like the Local Enterprise Partnership seem to sort of run things, really.
Are there any merchant venturers that sit on that, Mark?
I actually don't know.
I think you should look at the content and see who's looking.
Tell us, Christine. Tell us.
I couldn't give you individual names that sit on those, but they, you know, the Local Enterprise Partnership, certainly merchant venturers sit on that organisation, let's put it that way.
Okay, so that's it. Martin, this is one
I have
of
no
things,
proof on that.
This is one of the things that's happened.
Well, it's listed on their websites, Mark, cross-reference.
As our lovely democratic Bristol City Council, even though it's less democratic because it's just a mayor and people like Mark have got no say at all, apparently, they are being defunded up to 2020. It looks like you'll have only money for social care and nothing else by 2020. In the meantime, all the money's being shoved towards people like the Local Enterprise Partnership, who aren't elected at all.
Well, that's the Local Enterprise Partnership's there to provide capital investment. So it's the capital investment strains of it, which actually is providing money. I think the city, from its own point of view, I think if you ask most Bristolians, they would say they do want an arena. And actually, I think we're going to have to look at where that money comes from and look at the site that that's going to go on. I think this is right to do so at this stage.
What do you think is your prediction? Is it going to be in Temple Meads? Is there going to be the bridge to nowhere? Is it going to be a bridge to the arena, is it? Tell us, Mark.
I don't think it'll go on Arena Island. But actually, I also don't think we've wasted the money by building the bridge, because what you've done is by building the bridge, you made that land accessible, and that increases the value of it. So I actually think we'll get our money back on it.
Maybe we could sell that land off, make a few bob.
To Bristol University to put some student flats on, and guess who runs Bristol University, Mark? Have a guess.
I think I know who you think runs it, yeah.
Well, they do. It is a merchant venture, isn't it? It's merchant venturers that sit on the boards of Bristol University and Ewing.
I will take your word.
That's true, isn't it?
I will take
just
your word.
Steve. Squeezing this in before the news, there's just one other, and I'd like to get your comments on this, Mark. Student flat developers in Bristol exploiting tax loopholes to get out of paying business rates. Thangam Debonair, Labour MP, is calling for the law to be changed. So they're not paying business rates. Is that why there's so many business flats going up?
Well, actually, I personally think we actually need to look at the way that the student accommodation is being built in the city completely. I think Thangam actually does make a very good point. We've got an increasing number of students living in the city, and they don't actually pay any council tax at all. So they're not actually contributing to the services they use. Now, this is a real problem, and actually on a cross-party basis, the council are looking at
it. Isn't that why we're seeing so many student flats being built? Because the only money around is this free money for student loans?
But then you see, we then have a problem, because actually as the student flats are being built, you have more students being coming in, and you then have the normal families moving to the outside into South Gloucestershire, and we don't get the revenue.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest leader of the Tory group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston, and also to Christine Townsend.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.